Okay. Well, just to add a little piece to that, we're just emerging from Yale's, from our lab, is evidence that CO2 was maybe as high as 400 ppm during the height of the warming, and so that's about what it is today. And that implies a very high climate sensitivity, given that the Earth was about 3.5 degrees warmer 5 million years ago at levels of CO2 that exist today. And so really what you're talking about, if there's a CO2 linkage, is only tens of ppm making the difference into northern hemisphere glaciation between 400 and 290 ppm. All right, the next speaker is Tom Marchito. And I have to say, Tom, that if you went to visit your nona and your nonno in Italy, they would call themselves Marchito.
That's what I call myself.
Okay,
too.
Good. So just making sure that that we established that. And Tom's an assistant professor in Colorado in the Department of Geologic Science and is a research associate at the Institute of Arctic and Alpine Research. He received his BS in 1994. He's also a paleoceanographer and studies paleoclimate, but he uses and studies trace metal incorporation in carbonates and other things as well. So, and your talk. It'll be Ice Age, Deep Ocean Circulation, and Atmospheric CO2.
Thanks, Mark. And I'd like to thank the organizers of this reunion for inviting me to speak today. It's a great honor to be here. And it's great to be back in New Haven and at Yale. Okay, so Tim did a nice job of arguing for the importance of CO2 during glacial cycles. And what I want to do is talk a little bit about what we think we understand, and probably what we don't understand, about why CO2 varied on glacial interglacial cycles. And so Tim showed this same plot. This is the EPICA Dome Sea ice core. Now it's reversed. As a geologist would look at it, with time going forward to the left. But we have CO2 on the bottom, delta D, or deuterium isotopes, in the ice on the top, which is a proxy for air temperature. And we see this amazing relationship that they look like almost identical curves. And so the challenge here is, to me, why do these records actually look so similar? It's probably not as simple forcing of CO2 on temperature, because these temperature variations are order 10 degrees, and 100 ppm of CO2 is not going to do that. What I would say it points to is a common forcing of both of those records, that there's something in the climate system that's causing both CO2 and Antarctic temperature to vary in concert. And I'm going to point to, in particular, the Southern Ocean as the source of that forcing. So our focus on the ocean begins with a consideration of the different carbon reservoirs on Earth. And my first class, my first geology class at Yale, was taught by Carl Tarikian. And I remember this quote, or I hope I haven't butchered it too much. But when he taught us about mass balance, isotopic mass balance, or conservation of mass, he showed this old magazine ad with Dean Martin, I think, saying, "Everybody's got to be somewhere." Did I get that right, Carl? You're nodding. Great. So in the case of CO2 or carbon, if it's not in the atmosphere, it's got to be somewhere else. And where was it? Well, for the glacial interglacial problem, kind of 100,000-year time scale, there's a huge amount of carbon in the sediments in the crust. For the crust, I'm going to consider this to be interacting too slowly, sort of a tectonic time scale we'll put aside for the moment. Marine sediments can react on the kind of thousands of years time scale and probably is an important positive feedback, but I'm not going to talk about that today. Terrestrial biosphere is something that could interact pretty quickly, but we think during glacial time, during the last glacial maximum in particular, the terrestrial biosphere is actually smaller. That means that that's an extra source of carbon into the atmosphere. So now we have even more CO2 to explain, to put somewhere else. Well, that leaves the ocean, and the ocean is a large carbon reservoir, about 60 times as much as the pre-industrial atmosphere. And we think this was the major sink for Ice Age CO2. And we can look to Henry's law to say that PCO2 in the atmosphere at equilibrium should depend on the concentration of carbon dioxide in the surface ocean. What I'm going to talk about today is two different isotopic tracers we can use to start to understand how carbon was partitioned in the Ice Age ocean. And the first of these is a stable isotope, carbon-13. And I want to start by talking about what dissolved carbon looks like in the oceans. So this is DIC, dissolved inorganic carbon, which is all the components of carbon, inorganic carbon, CO2, bicarbonate, and carbonate. And what we see if we look at a section in the Pacific Ocean, this is a funny projection going up into the North Pacific and then across the North Pacific and then back down. So the Southern Ocean is at these ends, huge vertical exaggeration of about 6 kilometers, and then the whole distance of the Pacific Ocean. What we can see is low values in the surface. That's due to the so-called biological pump of algae taking CO2 out of the water. As those algae die and sink and decay, they regenerate DIC back into the interior of the ocean. So we see our modern DIC maximum in the North Pacific. C13, now we can't directly measure DIC in the past, but we can measure carbon-13 through the isotopic composition of foraminifera. And it turns out that if you look at a profile of DIC, total CO2 is the same thing as DIC, that C13 is the inverse of that. And that's because these algae that are removing CO2 are preferentially removing carbon-12, leaving the water enriched in C13. So we have an inverse tracer, or an inverted tracer, of the DIC distribution. And importantly, part of this increase in the surface ocean is also imparted by air-sea exchange. So some of those positive values near the surface is due to exchange with the atmosphere. So we've got this modern maximum of DIC and a minimum of C13 in the North Pacific. And if we look in the Southern Ocean, which is these two ends of the diagram, we can see evidence of the deep upwelling that happens in the Southern Ocean. So some of these relatively high values outcrop at the surface. And because biological productivity is limited in the Southern Ocean by a couple of different things, CO2 is able to leak into the atmosphere there, at least in the pre-industrial case. So the Southern Ocean, we would argue, is a special place and has a role to play in atmospheric CO2 natural cycles. So what did the glacial situation look like? And here I'm going to focus on the Atlantic Ocean, where we have the best data. On the left is a section through the Atlantic, where this is the south, that's the north, of modern Delta C13. So where DIC is low, C13 is high, and we see that the modern ocean is dominated by North Atlantic deep water. So these are from seawater measurements. North Atlantic deep water is a water mass formed in the North Atlantic, a low nutrient water mass. And we see slightly lighter or more DIC in this Antarctic water mass. Compare that to the glacial situation. This is a reconstruction for the last glacial maximum. This is based on using benthic foraminifera from different water depths throughout the Atlantic Ocean. And it shows a very different picture. The high C13 water mass that presumably originated in the north is now quite a bit shallower. We call it glacial North Atlantic intermediate water. And we see that the Antarctic source, Antarctic bottom water, has extended to fill much of the Atlantic Ocean, and it also had a much lower C13 value. So these blue colors are indicating light C13. This implies that this ocean, Southern Ocean, deep Southern Ocean, accumulated more carbon via remineralization of organic matter, or it was in poorer contact with the atmosphere, or some combination of those factors. So we can start to try to tease apart those two influences on the C13 pattern by looking at a second tracer for nutrient behavior, and that's cadmium. So cadmium is a trace element that, if you look in the modern ocean, its distribution closely resembles that of phosphorus. So it behaves like a nutrient. And to the extent that C13 behaves both like a nutrient but plus has this air-sea exchange component, the idea is we combine cadmium with C13, we can extract the nutrient part of C13 and be left with the air-sea part. So that's the modern distribution of C13. This is an estimate of the modern distribution of cadmium in the Atlantic Ocean, where North Atlantic deep water has low cadmium. So the first order, they inversely vary with each other. And in the glacial situation, we see that cadmium to the first order agrees very well with C13. This low nutrient water mass implied by the high C13 also appears as a low cadmium water mass. So that makes sense from a nutrient perspective. We see Antarctic bottom water had more cadmium in it, or accumulation of nutrients. But can that explain the entire C13 distribution? And we don't think it can, because you can take the cadmium, make a prediction for what C13 should look like if nutrient cycling was the only influence, and we'd find that there's additional information in the C13. And so this is sort of a difference map. This is now the air-sea component of C13. We've taken the nutrient part out using cadmium, and we find that this Antarctic or Southern Ocean deep water mass had lower C13 than what we'd expect from the cadmium values, implying a low signature of air-sea exchange. In other words, the air-sea process made C13 lighter than it is today. Because if you compare the same proxy, this would be same as air-sea C13. In the modern ocean, here's the Atlantic, and we see these purple colors, which are actually high values in the Southern Ocean. So this implies that since air-sea exchange increases C13, air-sea exchange must have been decreased at the last glacial maximum. So that's near the limit of what we can get, the information we can get out of the C13 for this problem. So I now want to turn to the other rare isotope of carbon, which is carbon-14. And of course, carbon-14 is radioactive, so it contains a clock. So we want to understand a little bit more about the nature of this deep water mass, okay? And take a moment to think about what we're actually measuring when we measure C14 of an ancient sample. So let's say we sample an old tree where we measure C14 ratio in the tree. That represents a measure of the C14 of the atmosphere when that tree first grew. That gives initial C14 through some biological fractionation of the tree. Then time goes by, half-life of 5,700 years, and we measure the current carbon-14 ratio. That's not my phone. similarly, for a foram, we measure it today, but it represents an initial C14, which was obtained from seawater, plus time to the modern concentration. And though time and C14, both initial and measured, are related in this way through the decay equation. Now, normally we're using C14 as a dating tool. So we would make this measurement, use an assumed value for initial C14, and then solve this for T. So that's the typical way that C14 is used. But if you have some independent control on T, you can invert the equation and actually solve for the initial C14. So if T is known independently, we solve for that value. And that tells us something about how the reservoir's C14 ratio changed through time. So we can use that method to reconstruct paleo C14 in either the atmosphere using trees or the ocean using carbonates. So this is what that reconstruction looks like. This is for the atmosphere. And we're looking back in time from the present back 60,000 years ago. Zero is the modern or pre-industrial atmosphere. So if nothing had changed, if the processes controlling C14 in the atmosphere were always the same, we should follow this line. In fact, very shortly back in time, we see the atmosphere go to much higher values. So there's more C14 in the atmosphere for all of the past 60,000 years, basically. And there's a couple of good reasons for that. One is that the amount of that C14 is produced in the atmosphere by cosmic rays in the Earth's geomagnetic field, as well as output from the sun, helps to shield the Earth from cosmic rays. So one reason to have more C14 in the atmosphere in the past is a weaker geomagnetic field. And let me just clarify something first here. So the C14 measurements is this line here. The green part of the curve is based on trees. The blue is based on foraminifera. So it's actually surface ocean, but it's been converted to atmosphere. And then this red line is a prediction based on reconstructions of the magnetic field for what how much C14 should have been in the atmosphere. We can see for the Holocene, in the last 15,000 years, the magnetic field makes a pretty good prediction for observations, but then there's a departure. The magnetic field can't explain all of the C14 rise. But another way to increase how much C14 is in the atmosphere is to have less of it taken up by ocean circulation. And so this orange line is, in this study, geomagnetic field plus a reduction in overturning circulation by about 50%. And we can see that we can get closer to observations. And again, everybody's got to be somewhere. So if we're leaving more C14 in the atmosphere, it implies that there should be a depletion of C14 in the deep ocean. So our prediction is that low C13 water mass focused in the southern ocean, the deep southern ocean, should have been depleted in C14 as well. But this has been an elusive problem. People have been looking for this, but it's a difficult doing backtracking to original initial C14 ratios by getting a good constraint on calendar age is very difficult in the oceans. And in deep sea cores, it's particularly difficult. So what we did is we looked at a shallow ocean core, an intermediate depth core from about 700 meters water depth, where the quality of the core was excellent and our constraint on time was excellent. Because remember, we need T, time, to solve for initial C14. And our approach here was to use the characteristics, in particular the color characteristics of this core, to provide an age model. The reason that works is that a number of low-latitude sites bear a striking resemblance to what we call the Greenland pattern of climate. This is a Greenland isotopic record of over the past 50,000 years, showing these characteristics, warmings and coolings, with kind of packages of warmings and coolings. And this is a measure of the color of this core, which is actually located off of Baja, California. It's just plotted versus depth here, so I haven't assumed any age model yet. But I think I can convince you that these variations are very similar to what we see in Greenland. So we use this relationship to take the Greenland age model and apply it to our core. So we're assuming no significant temporal lag between the two. This exercise is also aided by the fact that the sedimentation rate of this core is very constant through time. So if we have small errors in the age picks, it doesn't make that big of a difference. So this gives us T, and then we can measure the C14 and the benthic forams to get initial C14. And that record looks like this. So I'm showing again the atmosphere, which is the green and the blue curve here. And the red is benthic foraminifera from this site off of Baja, California. And what we see is that for most of the record, the benthic forams here at 700 meters more or less track the atmosphere, with two notable exceptions right here. During deglaciation, we get these what looks like two very strong minima in C14, which implies very old waters. In fact, if you were to say how old must these waters have been relative to the contemporaneous atmosphere, it's about 4,000 years, or about twice as old as any water you would find in the deep ocean today. So that's similar to the age of this presumed deep old reservoir that people have been fairly unsuccessful at finding in the deep southern ocean. The age of these waters is suggestive that this is a signal of those waters. So we think what we're seeing here off of Baja in the intermediate waters is the 14C signal of this release of old carbon from the deep sea. And looking at this in a little more detail across the last deglaciation, this is 8,000 years ago to 22,000 years ago. And the black dots is the CO2 rise coming out of the LGM into the Holocene. And in detail, we see that that happened in two broad steps, one here, then a slowdown in the rate of CO2 or even a slight reversal, and then another increase. If we look at atmospheric C14, it dropped as the CO2 was rising, then it plateaued as CO2 plateaued, and then it dropped again as CO2 rose. So this is implying that the atmosphere has been being diluted with CO2 that is old with respect to C14. And in fact, the timing of those CO2 releases agrees very well with these old pulses of carbon we see coming into the intermediate waters. So you may be asking yourself, why Baja California? That's, and I've alluded to the Southern Ocean as being a source or being important in this scenario. And our hypothesis is that we're actually seeing a signal being transmitted from the Southern Ocean through Antarctic intermediate water. So if we think to the glacial situation or last glacial maximum, one idea is that sea ice was expanded, surface ocean was perhaps better stratified, and ventilation of the deep Southern Ocean was poor. So that leak I talked about as existing in the Southern Ocean today was somehow capped. During deglaciation, those conditions relax. Sea ice retreats. Perhaps westerly winds retreat towards the Antarctic continent or contract, and deep convection begins again. And if that happens, if those two things are happening together, it can explain the covariation of warming and CO2 rise, because that retreat of sea ice and that contraction of the wind belts will also warm the continent as it's releasing CO2. So that can explain this close correspondence, where now the blue is the temperature in Antarctica. And again, that process being temporarily halted by what we call the Antarctic cold reversal, or a reversal into glacial-like conditions that was brief. One flaw in the PowerPoint. So this is covered up in four. Oop. Yeah. Somehow we lost this. But down here was a record of the rate at which North Atlantic deep water was presumably forming during this time interval. And what we observe is that during each of these two overturning events, or presumed overturning events, when CO2 is released, that North Atlantic deep water slowed down or possibly even shut down for periods of time. And so it's very difficult to establish cause and effect in this case, but one hypothesis that we have is that the north is essentially forcing the south, that if you shut down North Atlantic deep water formation, you can change things in the Southern Ocean in a couple of ways. One is through this idea of a bipolar seesaw. Basically, if you slow down the transport of heat into the North Atlantic, you're leaving more heat behind in the Southern Hemisphere. That can warm the Southern Ocean, cause sea ice to retreat, and increase the overturning. Another is that simply you need to be forming deep water somewhere. And so that if you shut things down in the North Atlantic, in order to balance global upwelling, you need to have overturning or production of deep water around Antarctica. So in either of those scenarios, it could be that the north is forcing the south, though the details of that are still quite unknown. So I'll just leave you with two take-home points about carbon isotopes. One, we looked at C13 paired with cadmium, suggesting that the Ice Age deep ocean was more poorly ventilated, in particular around Antarctica. And although I showed only the Atlantic, I wanted to mention that the Southern Ocean is the most C13 depleted deep water mass in the entire glacial ocean. So it looked more like the North Pacific does today. And although we don't have good C14 measurements of that pool, we think we see a signal of its release during deglaciation and possibly triggered from the North Atlantic. And since this conference is about challenges, a couple of challenges specific to this hypothesis. One is to better map this presumed release of C14 through the intermediate waters. So we're currently working off of in the Arabian Sea and off of Chile. We still need to find this old reservoir. It's pretty difficult to do. And lastly, I'd say that numerical models of climate are improving by leaps and bounds all the time. But one thing that's not done very well, particularly in GCMs, where it's usually not done at all, is incorporating biogeochemical tracers into the models to help us understand better what our tracer distributions mean in terms of the circulation. So, thank you.